Today at Reader's Corner, foreign diplomat Matthew Palmer, author of the novel Enemy of the Good. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The world of foreign diplomacy is a secretive one, and for those of us on the outside, it's also largely inaccessible. Veteran diplomat and author Matthew Palmer pulls back the curtains on this hidden world with suspense novels that offer an insider's perspective on conflicts and cultures in far corners of the globe. And he's done it again in his latest book, titled Enemy of the Good. The action in Enemy of the Good takes place in Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia, during a critical juncture in the country's relationship with the United States. The story centers on a second-generation Foreign Service officer named Kate Hollister, a clandestine mission and a difficult and potentially deadly moral dilemma. The book is a page-turner, certainly, but it also offers readers a rich and insightful account of a country we seldom hear about in the news from a career diplomat who has firsthand knowledge of U.S. international relations. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Matthew Palmer. He is a 25-year veteran of the U.S. Foreign Service, a life member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he has worked as a diplomat all over the world. Mr. Palmer was a guest on our show in 2016 to discuss one of his earlier novels, The Wolf of Sarajevo. He joins us today by phone from Washington, D.C. Matthew Palmer, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hey, Bob. Thanks very much for having me back on your show.
So, Matt, it's really interesting to follow people who write novels like yours. The only other guy I can think of who has a full-time job and also manages to produce the novels you do is David Ignatius, who I think is a working journalist for the Washington Post.
Yes, and I know David Ignatius.
Yeah.
I've done some business with him. We're both members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and it's a small town.
Right, right.
And I'm a big fan of his novels.
Well, I as well, but it's just so unusual. A lot of folks who produce novels at the clip you and David produce them don't have full-time jobs. And
that is in fact true.
And as director of the Western Balkan office, maybe we should start this interview before we get into the book, The Enemy of the Good. Tell us a little bit about what that entails, what you're actually doing. And it sounds very familiar because I think when you did one of your previous novels, it was based on some time you spent in the same area.
The Balkans is a place that is near and dear to my heart, and I've spent a lot of time in and out of that part of the world over the last 25 years. I have drifted back and forth from jobs working largely on East Asia and jobs working in the Balkans. So I am currently the director for the office that manages our relationships with seven Western Balkan countries: Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, Kosovo, Montenegro, Macedonia, and Albania.
That's like going back to one of your novels.
It is, in fact. And the Balkans is an endless source of fodder for materials, for stories, which is where my third book, The Wolf of Sarajevo, came from.
Right, exactly. I think I read somewhere someone asked you whether or not you had your next book all lined up, and you might have given some indication that you were going the Asia route. I think Burma was actually mentioned. Does this shift over to the Western Balkans suggest that you'd more likely keep your next book in an area where you're actually assigned and perhaps more knowledgeable?
I try not to write about the places where I'm working currently. I'd like to keep the worlds as separate as I possibly can.
Uh-huh.
Kyrgyzstan is not a place that I've worked on professionally. I did a lot of research for the book, and I got a nice note the other day from a former ambassador to Kyrgyzstan who was quite complimentary with how close I came to getting things just right about how it feels and what the politics are like. But I also did get a review for that book, for Enemy of the Good, from a publication that will remain nameless. It's a reputable publication, and it was a very nice review. And among other things, the reviewer wrote, "Kyrgyzstan is a fictional country, but the author includes so many real-world elements that you could almost believe it was an actual place." And I'm wondering, you know, about all that time that I put into the research. I'm thinking, maybe I didn't need to do any of that.
Right.
I could have just made it up. And then I could have made up a country that was easier to spell.
Well, now I'll tell you, I'm gonna do a confession here and show you how dumb I am. I was getting into your book like maybe a quarter of the way through, And I just made the assumption, hey, this guy writes novels. I've read three of them already. I really like them. Perhaps he made this up. And I went and found out, son of a gun, this whole area used to be called Turkestan, and then the Soviets broke it up into five stands, and Kyrgyzstan is one of them. And so I'm not, I don't think that reviewer is the only guy out there who doesn't know the stands well enough to know that when they did the breakup, they created one called Kyrgyzstan.
And I forget sometimes, for those of us who do this for a living, this is our bread and butter. This is the stuff that we do. And I forget sometimes what is common knowledge and what is maybe a little bit obscure to the point where it needs to be explained. And I try very hard in writing these books to make them accessible. I don't want them to be difficult. I don't want them to be intimidating or daunting. I'd like to reach as wide an audience as possible in America because I'd like people to understand what it is that the State Department does, what diplomats do, how we fit into the national security structure, and what benefits Americans derive from having a professional and capable diplomatic service.
By the way, while I was reading your book, what's the name of the largest city in Kyrgyzstan?
Bishkek.
Bishkek. While I was reading your book, some good friends of ours right here in Boise were on their way to Bishkek for a wedding.
A wedding in Kyrgyzstan can last for days.
Well, they had a wonderful time. They just were welcomed so graciously by the local community. And when I learned about it, I was in the middle of your book. And I texted them immediately and said, you have to pick up a copy of this book because it's
your great wedding present.
Exactly. It's all about it. It's all about it. And they did, and they really enjoyed it. But I also picked up a book called Restless Valley, Revolution, Murder, and Intrigue in the Heart of Central Asia. I assume you've
I'm
seen
familiar
that.
With it.
Yeah. And I guess that brings me to what is the Tulip Revolution, which sounds almost like a spin-off of the of your novel in the sense that this is about an uprising, a democratic movement rising up against a dictator. And I guess that's what the Tulip Revolution was all about, although I'm not so sure it turned out so well in real life.
I borrow in my books from reality. I borrow from recent history, and then I adapt them to fit the story. Uh-huh. So, you know, certainly the Tulip Revolution was a real event in Kyrgyzstan, which is now formerly the Kyrgyz Republic. And it exists in the background of the story, but really kind of where we are is a different political setup that is close to the politics of Central Asia, but adapted uniquely for purposes of the story. A Soviet-era apparatchik who had been running the place for the better part of 20 years. It's not a reflection of the current state of Kyrgyz politics, but it is consistent with what Central Asian politics have been over the last 20, 25 years.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the protagonist. This time you chose a woman protagonist. Tell us about that decision and also about the fact that she's not just a woman protagonist, but she's also somebody who doesn't mind speaking out and up and jeopardizing her career when she thinks it's the right thing to do.
That's exactly right. And she's paid something of a price for it professionally as well. She is, as you mentioned in the intro, she's a second-generation diplomat. Her father was an American diplomat. Her mother was Kyrgyz. And she grew up in and around the former Soviet space. And in fact, her ties to the United States were rather weak and tenuous. She didn't actually live in the United States until she went to the United States for college. And so in some ways, she feels about the United States the way you feel about a distant relative. You're affectionate, you love them, but you don't know them all that well. Mm-hmm. Now she's overseas representing the United States, speaking on behalf of U.S. policy, and in her heart and her head is at least as much Kyrgyz as she is American. And that leads to some tensions and some problems, including some folks on the inside in the embassy who don't trust her for exactly that reason.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Matthew Palmer, author of a new political thriller, Enemy of the Good. And the book centers around the United States' interest in a very important air base, and her uncle, the ambassador, is the guy that's trying to get this done. Help us with the real story of this, because as it turns out, there is a real Air Force base there. What's its strategic importance? Give us a little background there.
Sure. There was an air base that the United States was using out of the Manas airfield in Kyrgyzstan, and it was used primarily as a transshipment point for people and material going in and out of the Afghan theater. And so as a strategic base of operations for resupply, it was important. In the book, the air base that's under consideration would be a Soviet-era airfield that would be used as a base for the U.S. Air Force to put in strategic aircraft, meaning bombers and fighter aircraft that would be part of the overall military footprint in the region, which is different than the kind of airfield that we were using in the real world. And what I want to get at with that as a vehicle is the idea that the ambassador in the book, when he's explaining this all to Kate, refers to as values complexity,
right,
which means that the United States as a polity, the United States as an actor on the global stage, we want many, many things. And sometimes these things are supportive of each other, and sometimes they're contradictory. And sometimes a single issue comes to dominate the relationship and the agenda. And in the case of Kyrgyzstan, this access to this airfield has come to dominate the agenda to the detriment of all other interests, including democratic development and human rights and political freedoms. And Kate resists this and rejects it and rebels against it, in part because she wants for Kyrgyzstan what she feels is right for Kyrgyzstan, and not just for parochial, narrow U.S. interests. This almost inevitably brings her into conflict with her uncle, the ambassador, and with the American power structure.
Well, this sounds like something of an issue that would confront you as a diplomat on a fairly regular basis as you move around the world and as you hear these pleas for the human rights agenda, and yet you know there's a strategic interest on the part of the United States that have to be served?
It's always a challenge, balancing interests. And what the ambassador says to Kate in this story is finding this balance of interests is what we call policymaking. And it's an honor to be a part of that process. And, I've been part of it for 25 years. It's incredibly complicated, and it's incredibly difficult. It is an honor to do this on behalf of the United States and to represent the American people, but it's very hard.
So I'd like to talk about the politics of international diplomacy for a minute, and maybe you can shed some light on this. In your novel, at one point, Kate Hollister is planting inaccurate information in a conversation she's having with the Swedish ambassador, hoping that he's going to broker it so it's going to get back to the dictator, which is what she is hoping will happen. You describe the Scandinavian Foreign Service as actually training their junior diplomats to befriend American diplomats who are known for getting the best intel. First of all, is that true? Since this is a novel, I'm not going to believe everything I read. And secondly, if so, help us understand that. Is it just that we have a larger budget?
it's not just the Scandinavian service. It's a lot of diplomatic services from small to mid-sized countries that one of their best sources of information for what's happening in the country to which they're accredited will be the American embassy. And part of that is about budget and resources, and then a big part of it is about access, that people will see us because we're the United States, and we're a huge player in just about every dynamic everywhere in the world. So we have typically very good access. We have good sources of information, and people talk to us. They tell us stuff. And then diplomacy, one of the really the meat and potatoes and bread and butter of diplomacy is gossip as much as it is news. So diplomats like to chit-chat about what's happening in the country to which they're assigned. And the American diplomats have a reputation for having pretty good access, entree, and quality information. And so other diplomats are interested in accessing that information stream. And often they'll bring something to the table. They have their own sources and their own means of gathering information, and people will trade.
Well, let's get back to Kyrgyzstan and the revolution. The Epic of Manas comes into your book, and this is real. Why don't you tell us about the epic itself and how that plays into the narrative here?
The Epic of Manas is a long epic poem that is really the heart and soul of Kyrgyz culture, and what it centers around is three generations of leaders who welded together these disparate tribes of horse riding culture on the steppes hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and forging the Kyrgyz nation, the Kyrgyz peoples, fighting against enemies outside and inside. And it is, I would describe it as, if you were to roll up the tale of Genji and the Iliad and the Odyssey and Moby Dick and the works of Shakespeare all together, that it has that central and primal a place in Kyrgyz culture. There are professional reciters of Manas whose job is to know this incredibly long poem and tell these stories. It's in rural parts of Kyrgyzstan a form of entertainment, like watching, going to the movies or watching TV to go see one of these Manasi, one of the reciters of Manas, tell this story. And I use that story in the novel. I use the epic as a framing device, that Manas himself and Manas's descendants were warriors fighting on behalf of the Kyrgyz people. And this new democracy movement has adopted the tradition of Manas as an intellectual validator for what it is that they're doing, standing up to the dictatorial regime in Bishkek.
Now, you also, in the Epic of Manas, I don't think you mention it in your novel, but apparently there is a statue of Manas, and I think you do. Well, maybe you do mention the statue, because I think you referred to it as comic, and I think that has something to do with the history of how it got there rather recently, I assume.
There's a long and complex history of public objects of art in the former Soviet space that, you know, the Soviets had done a pretty good job of repressing local cultures, that they were interested not so much in the Kyrgyz people or the Turkmen people or the Russian people. They were interested in Soviet man, right? So a lot of that meant suppressing traditional culture, shunting to the margins the things that make people different in favor of the things that make them all the same. In the case of the Soviet Union, being loyalty to the Soviet state. So a lot of the traditional Kyrgyz symbols, traditional aspects of Kyrgyz culture were repressed and marginalized. And at the end of the Soviet Union, there were a lot of statues of Vladimir Lenin that were pulled down and replaced by some, in some cases, very hastily assembled monuments to Kyrgyz traditions. So there's been a lot of back and forthing in terms of trying to capture that public space and what it means to be Kyrgyz. And of course, it gets all wrapped up in politics, too.
And that statue is actually of Manas? Is that on a horse, as I understand it?
That's correct, and there is a very large statue in the central square that is one of the real landmarks of the city.
This is Bob Custer, and I'm speaking today with veteran Foreign Service diplomat Matt Palmer, author of Enemy of the Good and several other political thrillers. So you mentioned the steppes. Help us, especially those of us who have been nowhere near Central Asia, help us understand what this country looks like and what's its economy. And, well, we know it's politics, I guess. It's now independent.
Yeah. It's dominated by some very impressive mountain ranges, in particular the Ala Tu range that feeds into the Himalayas. So these are tall, formidable, snow-capped mountains that you can see from just about anywhere in the country. And at the foot of these mountains are plains, the steppes of Central Asia that have been the traditional home of horse riding cultures, horse breeding cultures, nomadic peoples. And so you'll get big valleys with flat bottoms on them, surrounded by tall mountains, accessible through narrow passes, rivers that are rushing snowmelt. It's still a wild part of the world and a beautiful, gorgeous part of the world as well. In terms of the economy, some of it's agricultural. There's some cotton that's grown. There's some mining of iron and copper. There's increasingly some tourism as people are discovering what a beautiful country, in fact, it is. And the opportunities to do ecotourism and horseback riding are really pretty extraordinary. So I would encourage folks to go check it out and visit it and see what a beautiful, welcoming place it is.
Well, you've traveled all over the world, and Kate Hollister is moving from Havana to Kyrgyzstan. And I had one paragraph in your book that I just stopped at, and I thought, boy, I'll bet Matt's colleagues are having a ball with this one. And, you know, by the way, I ran into a fellow diplomat of yours who will go nameless at the moment because I didn't ask him if I could use his name. He thinks highly of you and he thinks highly of your book. And I said to him at one point, I was laughing, I said, you know, Matt has a way of slipping into this novel some real life observations of life in the State Department. And he looked at me and he said, yes, but he can say it's all fiction.
There's a lot of truth in that.
Right. But I'll just read a piece of it. It's Kate trying to deal with her transition from Havana to Kyrgyzstan, which she says did not exactly go smoothly. And I guess that she says something like, but as Kate's father had once said after getting caught up in a particularly infuriating tangle of red tape, every time you moved, it was as though the department was moving you for the first time. You mean you're bringing your family with you to the post? Oh, you have a dog? Oh, the school year starts in September. It all seemed like a new experience for the personnel techs and administrative specialist who must have been Kate Newt, dealt with these very same routines over and over again.
You know, that is exactly the passage that almost all of my colleagues have highlighted.
Is that right?
Damn, I'm glad somebody is saying that. For purposes of this conversation, I'm just going to say, you know, it's a work of fiction.
Yeah, well, right. Well, I live in a large organization as well, and I could probably write the same kind of fiction. And I'll bet you there's all kinds of people reading this book who are coming from large businesses around the country and the world, for that matter, who are saying, oh, it happens there also, huh? That's good to know.
It's the kind of thing that shouldn't be as difficult as it is.
I hear you. So let's talk a little bit about this next job of yours and where that will take you. You don't want to write about the job you're in now, that's for sure. Again, getting back to Burma and Asia, your books have not gone in that direction yet. Is it likely that that's where you'll wind up?
I think at some point, I think Southeast Asia is going to be a place that I would like to set a story. The one I'm working on right now, I think, is going to be Afghanistan. So I'm going to stay around Central Asia for a little bit, but with the benefit of Afghanistan being a place that Americans are more than a little familiar with and where the issues are so compelling and immediate and dramatic.
What kind of research do you do to get a book off the ground like Afghanistan? Now, you'd have to refresh my memory as to whether you were actually in Afghanistan or not. But even if you were, I assume you have plenty of colleagues who can help you, not to mention, of course, research you can find at the local library.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't served in Afghanistan myself, honestly, but so many of my colleagues have, and it probably is in my future at some point, too. The way it works is an assignment there lasts for a year, and so every job turns over every year, and we're all going to need to do our time in hardship and unaccompanied posts. So I am thinking hard about an assignment in Afghanistan at some point in the very near future. But until then, I have scores of colleagues that have rotated through either the embassy in Kabul or one of the provincial reconstruction teams or one of the assignments with military units out in the field. A lot of folks that I can draw from for real-world experiences.
Now, we're talking to you from the Department of State in Washington right now, correct?
That's correct.
And you have been there for how long?
I've been here for 3 years.
3 years, yeah. I mean, you've really moved around the world. What's the impact on a family, and how does that work for your personal life?
It's tough for families.
Yeah.
And it's been hard on my spouse, who's a physician. She's a psychiatrist, and it's been hard for her to establish a practice that is consistent, something that she can build over time. She's made it work, but she's paid a professional price for my career. It's been hard on the kids. You know, kids don't like change. They don't like instability. They like the today to be the same as yesterday, to be the same as tomorrow. And so as much as my kids have had, I think, incredible experiences, and they've really seen a lot of the world, and they're very sophisticated in terms of their understanding of how the world works at pretty young ages. My boy is 16, my daughter is 13. It's been hard for them being asked to move every couple of years. So my goal would be to at least get my son through the end of high school 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. And then maybe my daughter could do her last 3 years of high school at our next overseas post. And then when both kids are out of the house, it gets a little easier.
Exactly.
Not for my spouse, but I don't have to worry about the kids' schooling so much.
Right. So how does the State Department look at this venture of yours? And I'll tell you, I mentioned this former diplomat who came here to talk to our students. He also spoke to our local Council on Foreign Relations Association and did an excellent job. But I was in the room when he talked to the students, and there was just no question that there were a number of those students who left the room that day interested in the Foreign Service, interested in international diplomacy, interested in international work of any kind. He made the point that you don't have to pass the foreign relations test to get into this kind of work. There's all kinds of NGO work. There's great opportunities for students. And your novels, in a way, when I finish reading them, I even think, you know, I'm an old political science major. I guess maybe that's the reason why I react as I do. But I'm thinking, wow, if I was young reading this book, I'd want to head off for Georgetown's Foreign Relations School or take the test and take off to see the world. So in one way, I think these novels of yours are almost, I don't want to belittle the importance of your novel, but it's a great public relations opportunity for the Department of State.
That's exactly what I'm hoping they are. That one of the things that I wanted to do in writing these things was to demystify the world of diplomacy, to help Americans understand what it is that diplomats are and what they do. There's an image, I think, that most people have of diplomats, some old heavyset guy with a walrus mustache and striped pants, you know, pushing cookies and tea on visitors, and then doing soulless deals with the devil. And that's not what we are at all. We're patriots working to advance the interests of the United States in a complex, multidimensional world. And to the extent that I can make that feel real and tactile and engaging and compelling to people, I think it's great for American diplomacy. I think it's good for broadening the reading public's understanding of what foreign policy is all about. And if it does some good for the State Department and the Foreign Service along the way, so much the better. So, yeah, I love this profession. I love this institution, and I want to do something for it.
Well, you have. You have, without a doubt. These four novels are certainly my favorites. And, again, I encourage our listeners to get out and get the latest one, Enemy of the Good, and then you can go back and start reading the other ones if you haven't read those. But, Matt Palmer, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book, Enemy of the Good by Matthew Palmer.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Matthew Palmer. Next week, Amy Goldstein, author of Janesville, An American Story. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you've missed some of our previous interviews, you'll find them on our free app for mobile devices. Download it from Google Play or the App Store to listen anytime.